Welcome to Vox Vomitus, also known as Word Vomit.
No, I'm just kidding.
Hello, everyone. I like that we just went live and like Allison and I cackled at the same time. Welcome to the latest edition of Vox Vomitus. I am your host, Jennifer Ann Gordon, the author of the Kindle Award-winning novel, Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, as well as Pretty Ugly and the Hotel series. Joining me today, as always, is my very beautiful Vox Vomitus vixen, Allison Martine, author of the Bourbon books, which includes Dibs, Since September, Move On Melinda, and Climb the Salmon Ladder. Joining us today is the one, the only Ed Amar, author of No Home for Killers. I can't really see out of this mask, so I don't know if I have the book in front of the screen.
You do.
Awesome. You might be wondering what's going on with these creepy masks that we're wearing. Ed's going to tell us all about the masks, the book, and what it's like being just a hero for surviving the flu that you had.
And the flu.
So, thank you so much for being here.
And sending us these.
I have to say, I saw Ed on Facebook posting with these, and I said, we need to have him on the show because there is no way that we're not going to wear these for part of the interview. If you are familiar with our show, we occasionally dabble in a little prop comedy, except it's not super funny.
No, it's mostly just, it makes us laugh. That's the important part.
So Ed, tell our viewers and our listeners a little bit about you and a little bit about No Home for Killers.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer and Allison, for having me on. I have listened to you guys chat. I don't know. I think I reached out to you, Jen, and told you that I was listening to you sing the praises of
Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Yes,
Negan. But only when he's a jerk.
Only when he's a bad. Yeah, and I mentioned that my wife has the same reaction to John Hamm. She only likes him, but only when he is in bad. Not when he's like doing comedy.
Yeah, like not on SNL, but when he's just being kind of like a womanizing drunk on Mad Men. Yeah.
I need to know what she thinks of him in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, because there he's funny and likable, but also a cult leader who held people hostage for like decades. What do you do with that?
We never saw it. Should we?
Okay, we should go check that out. It is very funny, and he's the one who had Kimmy Schmidt in a bunker for years and years and years.
Okay. All right. It's on the list. I have to see Andor, apparently. And right now I'm going through Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So I'm like also way behind.
Noise.
Gosh. Yeah, I haven't seen any of those.
I love Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I wouldn't say it's an accurate depiction of policing in America right now or fits into the conversation we're all having, but really funny show.
It's worth it. It's worth it. And it is not accurate because they're likable police officers. So
I was just hoping we could spend most of the time talking about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I know you haven't seen it, but I would like
to. Yeah, I haven't seen it. But I mean, if we can spend some of the time also talking about, I'm watching the show, Kevin Can Go F Himself.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I didn't know that one too.
Which is really good. So if we can talk about that a little. And Allison, what are you watching?
Well, we actually just finished a few things, and including Wakanda Forever. So we're like, Wakanda Forever. Oh, and then beyond that, we're like, what are we supposed to watch next? And we want to see The Last of Us, but that's on HBO, which we don't have at the moment. So it's like, what are we going to start binging next? And we started watching something, I want to say it's called Free Ridge. I still don't really know what I'm watching, but it feels like Disney stars grew up just a little bit, and then they've got a cursed box. I really don't know what's happening yet. I cannot recommend yet. It's too early, but I'm just kind of like... All right.
So now that we've done TV Corner, where we
I should introduce myself.
Yeah, you should introduce yourself. And like maybe talk a bit about this
one. Sure. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll just go with my standard introduction. Playboy, former Jeopardy champion, self-made millionaire.
Are we doing two truths and a lie?
I was going to say, are any of these true? Because
no, I haven't. I'm none of those
about
things.
Being on Jeopardy.
I'm the opposite of all that.
But,
So yeah, I'm Ed Amor. I write under E.A. Amor. Very clever nom de plume. My newest book, No Home for Killers, came out last week. It was technically out January 1st because it was part of Amazon's first reads, which I did not know was the launch date. So when reviews came in, I was very freaked out. I was like, yeah, and also I wasn't emotionally prepared. So that was it. That was great though. It was awesome, but it was disarming. And No Home for Killers is a story about a murdered jazz musician who's acclaimed, but he's also privately abusive. And his two sisters, his estranged sisters, who are brought together to find out what led to his demise. And one of them is a former social worker who's burnt out. The other is a younger sister is a secret vigilante who's also a grant writer.
And I know. So we knew nothing about this book. Like, I knew nothing. Jen's just like, we saw this and we're like, well, we have to have him on the show. If he's got masks for us, I don't care what the book's about. We're going to watch. And then when I started actually reading the book and I knew who wore this, I was so excited to get to wear it because of who is behind the mask and what their motives are. And I'm like, three strikes, I'm in. Yeah, let's do this.
For those who, I guess for the podcast people who are listening, they have both Allison and Jen have Jennifer.
Again, okay. I write under Jennifer Ann Gordon because just Jennifer or Jen is like, ugh.
I think you should go by just Jennifer.
Just Jennifer.
So they, I sent them masks that are modeled after the mask of the vigilante in the book wearers. And if you're not listening, I'm actually at DC's 930 Club in front of a group on a live stage. I'm doing this live in front of a group of, I guess there's 400 to 500 people here who are
They're
fans.
Very well behaved.
Yeah, no applause.
My children ever are, that's for sure.
They're just because they're them. In awe. They were like, not the Ed E.A. Amor, author of No Home for Killers.
Nobody introduces me like that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Go ahead.
This is when Allison's about to start snacking.
Look, I already have a cough drop in my mouth. So as soon as it's gone, I'm hitting the Lucky Charms marshmallows, which is very funny because as soon as I read that, I'm like, my child does that because she asks for a bowl of Lucky Charms, no milk, and then proceeds to only eat the marshmallows. And then I just get a bowl of, what is it, weird-shaped Cheerios? I'm going, what the heck, child? So I had to go and get my own this morning before she got to it to get all my Lucky Charms marshmallows in honor of your book.
They, because there's a scene early in the book where Emily has beaten up somebody, the vigilante, and she's bored and waiting for somebody to come so she can find out who he's working with. And she's perched high in a tree and she throws a Lucky Charms at his head in boredom. I should mention that Emily's a bit, you know, she's there's a cartoonish side for her that I like to, you know, I had in mind this idea that she could be the kind of character who's like hopping from rooftop to rooftop and throwing bombs or something like a Green Goblin or the Deadpool of crime fiction. But then Melinda, her older sister, who's much more grounded and stable. Also
she wears mom jeans. She's not even a mom. I probably dress like Melinda right now.
Yeah, and she has she also has this fantasy that she's engaging, which is, you know, in the form of an extra boyfriend, marital,
an affair.
Yeah, an affair. And she they have those fantasies and they both end up sort of being roughly grounded. Which was kind of, I didn't realize that till I read a review who pointed that out. And I was like, oh, you're right.
I love it when reviewers tell you what your book's about and you're like, I am smart. I am smarter than I was.
Yeah.
Oh, symbolism. That, yeah. Oh,
so much smarter than my whole Deadpool of crime fiction thing.
Hey, I feel like that works. And I have to wonder, I know your agent. I love your agent. I think she's amazing. I met her at New England Crime Bake. I am the agents and editors chair for that on the committee. So how did you pitch this to Michelle Richter? Ed's amazing, hilarious agent. Did you say Deadpool of crime fiction?
I hope you gave her some lucky arms and said, here you go. This is my book. I mean, it worked. So, I mean, you know, it's fine.
So I've been working with Michelle. I was one of her first clients. We started working together in 2015, I think. And she had just gotten into the industry and I was looking for, I was at a point where I felt like I could sort of not pick and choose who I wanted, but I was like, I'm going to do, you know, what you do with like agents or publishers or short story magazines, you get your top tier and then your middle. So she was my top tier. I really wanted to work with somebody who was new and hungry. And I love Fuse. I loved Lori McLean, who ran the agency Michelle was with. And I'd followed her and her blog post for a long time. And so Michelle and I worked together. God, I guess it's like 7 years now. And I'm terrified, 8 years. I'm terrified she'll dump me at some point. But when this book came out, or not came out, when it got, when it sold, I told her, I was like, you have stuck by me for so long with it, with like very few rewards. And I
your
am
sparkling personality, Ed. That's
bless her heart.
It's a lot of machismo, you know, goes a long way.
That's when you channel your inner Eduardo.
Yeah. I was gonna say we really love a good strong, overly masculine energy these days.
And that's what I exude, and I just can't help it. You know? But Michelle was, she kind of likes that. I mean, she's got, you know, she's got Kelly Garrett, who she met at Crime Day. She's Tara Laskowski, Alan Orloff, so many others. And they're all different, you know, we're all sort of different styles. And I think she likes that. She's been awesome to work with. I'm so happy to be with her.
I have to say, it makes me, like when you said, I'm so petrified she'll dump me at some point in time. Because I think we as writers, like once we get like an agent we really love, which I have an agent I really love, Paula Mounier.
I'm with Paula.
Allison's with Amy Collins. And like the second you get an agent you really like, all of a sudden, my immediate thought is, what if she decides that she doesn't like me anymore? Like the second, like sign the contract.
It happens. And it is not uncommon in this business to go through more than one agent. I will not say any more than that. I'm going to eat this boom on.
Michelle is not my first agent, but I hope she's my agent for life. And it's tough, right? Because at that point you sign with an agent and you've entered the business side of writing. Yes. And it's totally different. And I don't think many writers can do are built to do both well. I mean, the rejection and the hardship and the length of time it takes to traditionally publish really requires so much, and your skin gets toughened. But then when it comes to actually being on the published side of selling your book and knowing how to pitch it and how to approach people and what needs to happen, very few, that usually doesn't happen before your first book comes out.
No.
So it's
not generally, no,
it's tough. I the business of writing, I've worked a lot with sort of mentoring debut or aspiring writers because I made so many mistakes and I feel like I can't talk to people about me,
two opposite. I mean, I feel very similarly because my journey enough is people are like, wow. And then that, wow, that too. And I go, I swear my story is not, it's not unique, but it's also not the par for the course. So you could probably skip some of these things by making better choices than I did, or just having better luck than I did. Maybe eat some more of the purple horseshoes. Horseshoes are for luck, right?
Yeah. Horseshoes are for luck. That's why they were in Ed's book. He put them there for symbolism reasons.
Yeah. Right. Because they're horses.
And lucky. And not for the horse. So, Ed, do you have a music background? The way you talk, you talk so much about jazz and songwriting.
Jazz singing and the vocal quality.
And
there's lyrics in the book, so not that people could actually see very well. And for everybody listening, they're like, stop showing things on the camera. Each part has lyrics from a book or from a song that are attributed to a character that you made up. So can we listen to this somewhere? Is there a download somewhere?
So that's funny because I love music. I have no talent whatsoever. I just don't have the time, and maybe I would. I don't, maybe the time or patience or inclination for a certain instrument to really learn it. It wouldn't come naturally to me. So it would take a lot of work. But I love music. And I love jazz, and jazz was sort of my like stomping ground when I started getting into writing. So the two came together, and I made friends with a jazz singer. So I host this DC Noir at the Bar series, and we always do, it went virtual, and I've done it, but I always say we, it's just me. But
it makes me sound much more like an organization and
not just like a dude at a bar going, getting drunk and going, I'm going to tell you a crime story. People who are just like, I don't want to hear.
Sit down.
You're not going to go anywhere.
No,
it's called three strikes.
We did this series and went virtual. And at this point I can actually say we, cause I worked with Chantel Sang, who makes custom cocktails based off of books. And she would do a cocktail demonstration based off one of the books that a writer was reading that evening. And then my friend Sarah Jones, who's a jazz singer, and she would do a little noir themed jazz song during it. And we did 14 virtual events in 2020, and it was a lot of fun. And each event was in support of an indie bookstore, which was really cool, because we have so many in the DC area and they were all freaking out because of COVID. But what I would, my friend Sarah, I asked her like, hey, would you, I wrote these lyrics and I have an idea for a song. Do you think you could help me put it together? Cause she knows a ton of people in this area who record. And she was like, I'd love to. She's like, tell me, I got the lyrics. What's the beat? And I was like, it's like da 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 da. And she was like, that's nothing.
Music part stuff.
Yeah. So that is not anything I can speak to. That it would have been cool. It would have been kind of neat, but I was like, you're just busy with stuff. And I was like, I don't have time to really make up songs or learn songwriting.
No, and that's where my level is too. And not in anything I have published, but I wrote a middle grade fiction and I put songs in there and I can hear them in my head. Mm-hmm. But being able to get it from in my head to something that someone could put down on across the staff or play on a guitar, I'm like, no, there's a disconnect there. And me just kind of humming at them, they'd be like, no, I'm basically Lisa Simpson. Tappa, tappa, tappa. Tappa, tappa, tappa. It's not very helpful to anybody else. Hey, in my day, we would have killed for tappa, tappa, tappa. Who wants to know what subgenre of jazz is your mainstay and what is your favorite jazz album?
It would be tough to say. I mean, I haven't listened to jazz as regularly as I used to for a long time. But I would say there is, and actually having an album... Billie Holiday was always sort of the person I looked to a lot, and any of her, I can't remember the name, but this label that put out these like recordings of top songs to different musicians, and Billie Holiday definitely was one. There's a jazz album by Django Reinhardt's violinist Stefan Grappelli, where he works with pianist Earl Hines, and they work together on, and they put these beautiful songs together. And I love that. There's so many. I mean, I was really into Dave Brubeck at first. The thing is, now I'm really like, for years, my mainstay for music's been hip hop. So I listen to hip hop a ton, and then there's a DJ/producer I like a lot who mixes in a lot of jazz with his hip-hop, named El Orange, and I'm really into him. So if you're interested in hip-hop and you like jazz, let's say you like jazz and you're curious about hip-hop, El Orange is a great person.
That's a great Venn diagram. I'm gonna have to check that out, because so I teach, my day job is I'm a ballroom dance teacher, and jazz is just the home of the foxtrots for us. Mm-hmm. Sometimes our students like to mix it up. And I feel like if I did something that was like jazzy with a little bit of hip hop that they could do some swing during, they would probably be less bored than me playing, jazz standards for the thousandth time.
where they're just like, we know this one.
I really wanted to write about jazz in the book. And originally I had, so Marcus is the musician in the book. He's murdered. He's been murdered. He's dead. And he, he was a third POV. And he wasn't alive. These were like POVs leading up to his death. Okay. And my editor, Jessica Wells at TNM, who I adore and is fantastic. Was like, so there's one thing with the Marcus POV. I just hate him. And I was like, I get that. You hate him.
You just hated him? Jessica did?
Yeah.
She's like,
not super likable.
Her thought was like, the book is really about his effect on these two women and the woman in his life. And that's their story you should be telling.
Yeah.
And I was like, that makes sense to me. But losing him meant I lost a lot of his, like background with jazz.
Yeah.
Did you get that in then through Rebecca? Because we have Rebecca too. Because the two points of view, I mean, this is a story about these sisters, Melinda and Emily, but then you also throw in Rebecca Winters, who is someone he had been involved with, and then the whole story with him and whether or not her family had been involved in his death, because it starts with learning he has been killed, but we aren't clear exactly who or how he got killed. He just did.
Right. Yeah. So Rebecca did give me that, right? She's his, like you said, his ex and a fellow jazz musician. And she gave me that sort of, I couldn't put too much in there. I couldn't take everything I wanted to in there, but that's the whole, killing your darlings kind of thing.
Yeah. Right? Oh, you did that so literally a lot.
I know.
That's, a couple of people die in this book. Yes.
I know. Yeah.
And like, in some really very visceral described ways there. Uh-huh. And I was like, whoa, that's a lot. I wanted to have a prop of like a baton, but all I had in my house was like a little mini flashlight. And I was like, and it just like would go like, chick. And I'm like, that's not very, or a curling iron.
Okay. And I'm switching back in my head when I hear baton, band geek, I'm picturing like a majorette spinning this thing. And that is not what she, she's like,
it's like a policeman's baton, sort of, except it's retractable. So
because it retracts, exactly. It's not majorette, and I'm sure Emily would be like, that would be fun too, but not probably as effective.
Yeah.
She would like it though. I mean, if she could twirl a baton and like really like take out a few people at once. Man.
Well, getting back, you originally compared her to like Green Goblin, and I would say the closest comic counterpart to her, she's got a little bit of Harley Quinn going
on. Harley Quinn?
Yeah, really does. Yeah.
And when you were describing, there's another character in here, I'm like, so Kingpin, that's Kingpin.
Yes.
When this gets made into a movie, will Vincent D'Onofrio be too old to play the character? Because, I mean, he's already doing that for Marvel. He's so good. I'm sure he can do it. He won't mind.
Doing this thing where I whisper a lot? Am I saying like, he's so good and it's not coming through?
No, we can hear you.
Okay,
it sounds like a little like stalkerish and weird though, but I like it. Like he's so good.
Stalkerish and weird?
Yeah.
Well, I am in a car stalking someone. So that's this background is not, this is virtual. I'm actually in a stoplight.
Virtual background with the stuffy behind you. I mean, like, how do you get that to stay there? Did you show us the stuffy when we were live, or that was that just before?
No, I think it was before we were live.
Show everyone the stuffy. And I know for people who are just listening, we apologize. They don't get to see the cute little three strike stuffy with her own little hoodie, own little outfit. It's the cutest little vigilante.
It's the sweetest little vigilante you'll ever see.
Yeah, I don't know why I got it. I'm not really sure. Like, I like the mask. I got the pens, the little postcards. But then I was like, that cost $120, and I'm like, I can't really send this out anywhere or do anything with it. So it just comes with me to all of
every convention you go to, every panel you're going to sit on. Is it going to be at like BoucherCon in September?
Until it gets weird.
Yeah.
Until people are like, maybe why are you carrying that thing around still?
Just be like, it's my emotional support vigilante.
That came with me to my first signing, and he sat behind my stuff, so only me and my PA for the day could see him. But it was important for him to be there, and I don't see anything wrong with having emotional support figurines or stuff.
I usually just bring emotional support alcohol with me too.
That's good too. You could also bring emotional support Roman. He's possibly
there. Oh, he's bored at them. He's there, but he's like not like with the authors doing the author thing. Yeah, the last true. New England Crime Bake, I did bring him out for because I didn't show him off. Some of our agents found him incredibly handsome, and I was like, "Here, Roman, just keep the ladies happy."
I heard you talking about that. As I was stalking you, not on your podcast, just
just like the there, the other day at the store.
But who do you have? Oh, it was a Damiante, right? Damiante.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she was talking about the burden of being with people who are attractive.
Okay, it's so hard.
It's pretty difficult.
Well, like my first signing, I did make sure that I brought someone who was better looking than me, younger than me, and more outgoing than me. And I'm just like, this is my emotional support, Laura, and she will be the one to talk to people when I'm like,
your booth babe.
She was my booth babe. And then there was another booth there where the author was gorgeous and she had like five PAs and they were all gorgeous and were like, they're supermodels. I'm scared of them. They were all very, very lovely people, but we're just like, it's supermodel fell over there. What's going on?
I mean, generally, I like going to crime fiction conventions mainly because I feel so young and spry.
Are you saying that the general age, the average age, is maybe of an upwards number?
Yeah, and I'm in the upwards number, so I don't mind.
We're all in the 40 blurry zone.
I was going to say,
if we were all Leonardo DiCaprio, we shouldn't be dating a 19-year-old age range.
I don't like that. It really bothers me that there are so many men who do that. I don't want, I always tell my wife that if, she dumped me or died or something like that, for one thing, I think I would do very well because I'm a single dad with a kid. And I think that's
total, bait for women.
That's like
total magnet, right?
Yeah.
And we have a dog. We have like a puppy, like, so I'm really well prepared for this.
You're fine.
But I always feel like I would not want to date someone younger at all. I want, I don't want to like, that seems gross. I would rather, I'm 48, maybe within like about 10 years older than me, who's just like, and I want her to have like a smoking history. Like, I picture this woman saying like, Ed, come here.
You want to get your pants off. It sounds like me right now.
Just like, get your pants off. Get over here. Come on.
My husband is younger than I am. And for years we joked that like, anytime I would talk to him, I'd be like, stick with me, kid. We're going to go fly together. We're a great couple. Come on. And that's like the voice I think that he hears when I talk.
Mm-hmm. It might be.
Yeah.
And I'm older than my husband too, but not the age difference is not quite as much, but it is kind of funny because when we first met, people then usually assume, oh, you must be younger than your spouse, because the assumption is always the woman is younger. So I instantly shaved a few years off, just people thought his age, and then removed more. I'm like, I just lost a decade. This is nice.
I know. Yeah. People sometimes think I'm in my 30s and I'm like,
thank you.
My wife is adopted, and she, not recently, she wasn't adopted like 3 years
just
ago
like,
or something.
It was me. I'm so happy. But, forever home.
And she's always like, what if I find out that I'm actually like 10 years younger than I think I am or something?
Oh, come on. Like,
she would have to know.
A cryogenic freeze. It's one thing if they didn't know maybe a year or two, but 10 years, come on.
I mean, 10 years would be a lot, but maybe a year injury? Or two, could be a year something or two. Like that.
I mean, and you never know if you get bonked on the head hard enough when you're a kid, like with a swing.
Well, yeah. I was, but that's fine.
We've all taken some.
Just drop me down the stairs. That's fine.
My kid fell down the stairs when he was like two. He just went running over to the stairs. I mean, it was terrible. I almost had to look up for my phone, but I didn't.
But you were okay, and so was your phone.
I was there. He was fine. I heard him crying, but he climbed back up.
Yeah, it teaches them resilience.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's
he's fine.
Totally fine.
Let me ask you both something as fellow writers. I want to ask you a craft question I've been thinking about.
Oh.
What do you think? So I'm thinking about the book and I'm thinking like, I wanted to write a book when I wrote this that was really spoke to me. And and because I was so impressed with the books that Sean Cosby, S.A. Cosby, as you know.
Yeah, S.A.
And Alex Segura mm-hmm. had written and Kelly. And I was like, these books are very much books that they would write. You know what I mean? Like, this is mm-hmm. their book. This doesn't feel like they're writing for anyone but themselves. And I thought about that and I was like, this book to me, you know, I mentioned it, you know, when I think in my newsletter or something, that No Home for Killers is my most personal book. And it was really just, you know, I didn't know if it would work because this is the book I just wanted to write, the story I wanted to tell, the ending I wanted. But I wonder now, you know, looking back a year after it was written, looking, you know, at most of the reviews have been good, but, you know, it's a harsh book at times. And yeah, people have reacted to that. And I wonder, like, should I have taken more, should I have paid more attention to the reader, the audience?
You know,
what do you, how do you both look at that?
So I feel like this is going to harken back to what we were talking about kind of earlier, where mm-hmm. it's like the business of being a writer and like the art of being a writer are sometimes two different things. I tend to write, the books I have out now are horror,
yeah,
based or in the horror world. The book I have out on submission is in the crime-ish world. But, and it, that book was a struggle for me at times because I knew this was the book that was going to be like going out there into the great big world, getting on fancy editors' desks. So some of it, like, I don't want to say wasn't joyful writing, but I was thinking of, would this be in an airport?
Mm. Yeah. Would a, you were much a book more club, aware of, yeah,
like moms who drink wine, that would they, yeah, would yeah. they like this, or would they go, oh, that thing with the Barbie doll down the throat was too much for me?
What?
Yeah.
People couldn't see my reaction when my eyes just went, and I will say
it was too much for me. I wrote it and my husband read it and he's like, maybe that part shouldn't be in it.
Did you
and
I'm take
like,
it out? Did Paula have you take it out? Is it still you haven't let me read it yet, so I don't know.
I think it might still be in there. I think Paula did not make me take that out. She made me take out a couple other things that she was just like, nope.
Yeah, and I will.
This is not horror.
I will echo. So I write in two genres under two different pen names, and my rom coms, since I did those primarily with a small press and then on my own, those no one stopped me, and I'm like, I can do what I want, ta-da. And then my spec fic is what I've been dealing with agents and going through the traditional channels. And the first one, which died on sub, we did have some people reorganize things in terms of, yeah, you're completely non-linear here and you need to re-linearize it just so people can follow. It's still died on sub, that's fine. And the one that is currently about to go on sub in the next month, it had some parts in there that I had some readers tell me that was too much. And I'm like, eh, you read middle grade fiction. You don't know what you're talking about. Sure. But my agent has not yet told me to take it out. So we'll see whether I'm told it is too much or too excessive. And it's also the darkest thing I've ever written. And I don't usually write that dark. So it's like, is it all that dark? Is it just feel dark for me? Are my readers just not expecting it because they have other expectations for me? I will say for your book, I don't feel like you crossed lines in terms of like,
okay,
too shocking sensibilities. I don't feel like you did that. There was no place where I'm like, there should have been more trigger warnings. But I think what you did, and you did phenomenally well, is the scenes that haunted your people, like your characters were haunted by certain things. And those things you hit home in a way that wasn't disturbing, but you could see your characters were disturbed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like, yeah, that's really nice to hear.
Melinda, and Melinda's like, this, I couldn't get past it. But I didn't read it and go, I have to put the book down, or I've got to do a Joey Tribbiani and put the book in the freezer and walk away. I didn't feel that way about it, but the fact that you were able to have the characters respond in that way showed me how it hit for them. And that was the important thing, because every reader is going to respond differently. They're all going to have their different trigger levels, but yeah. For your characters, you could see where the characters were affected, and you wrote that incredibly well. And there's like a scene later that I can't spoil, but you describe something so vividly and specifically how different it is in movies and how it would be in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that one was like, it was hard to read, but it didn't cross the line. So I don't think from a craft perspective that you left the reader out, or I just wrote from your heart and forgot about the people. I think you did a
But I love it when people write from the heart. Honestly, like, I would rather, as a reader, be a little bit disturbed by something and then later on talk to the author and have them say, this was the book of my heart. Like, that I'm just like, oh, good.
I think
rather than have to pull it back. Yeah.
You know, I mentioned that I worked with aspiring Navy writers. And one of the things I did was Pitch Wars in the last year it was around.
Yeah, rest in peace.
And yeah, and it was the first year I did it, and the last year it was around. And my mentee, when I was going through the manuscripts, I was like, you know, I realized that I will take a book that I don't think is, you know, terribly well written or structured, but if it's got a pulse in it, I mean, mm-hmm. if you can, and you can tell, right? You can just tell with something where the writer is invested, and this book is uniquely theirs.
It's just like, this is alive.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, or like, you know, you can fall in love with a book based on like the author's voice and just be like, I don't like the plot. I don't like the characters. I don't like anything, but I just like, I love something here.
I think it depends on your
craft is something that can be taught, and voice is a lot harder to teach, because if the person doesn't have inherently a strong voice, you can tell them to keep going and reading more, and then their voice is going to sound more influenced by what they read. But what their own inherent voice is, what's that building from? And if that doesn't resonate with me, it's hard to ever kind of get it there. But that's just me.
That's, yeah, you know, and for me, I find like, I really don't, you know, my genre is crime fiction. So it's mainly almost entirely at this point what I read. And, you know, I don't find the crimes compelling. Not usually. I mean, no. In a great book, certainly, but it's the characters. It's the relationships between them and how well they're developed. I mean, sometimes there's writers who I feel like their strength is probably in character relationships, and they throw in the crime because, you know, you have to. But it's not necessarily integral.
Yeah.
Right. No. Yeah. I get it. That's why, like, I jokingly, like, my book that's out on sub, I'm always like, oh, it's crime-ish. There are crimes that happen, but is that really what the story is about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. It's about, you know, broken people doing broken things. And and that's what I like to read, whether it's crime fiction, horror fiction, literary fiction. I like to read about broken people. When I went to school for theater, that's what I wanted to play, the broken people, because they are much more fun and much more interesting to explore than the person who's having the greatest day ever.
It's probably why I think crime fiction is maybe one of its better periods, because so much of it right now is based off. Well, I think there's two things. One, there's so much that's based off identity and other voices, and voices that have traditionally been othered. So whether it's queer writers or writers of color or women, you're seeing so many more voices come out, and those voices are bringing characters that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, because it's not just fantastic. That old white grizzled detective.
Yeah.
It's the detective. Who's so much like from retirement.
And you have so many women writers in crime fiction outside of psychological fiction that are doing so much with insight and with character. And it's just fascinating. I write, most of my protagonists are women, and
you write women very well. I just have to say that. Like, there have been, you know, obviously times in the past that we have, you know, read something for our show, our singular shows, just read something that we are beta-ing or blurbing. And I'm like, let's say it's a male writer writing a female perspective. And I'm like, it doesn't ring true. A lot of times it does, but then there, when it doesn't, I'm like, you missed it. Yeah.
My thought on that, knowing guys, knowing male writers, you know, is that they want to show off, and they want to say, ladies, let me tell you what cramps are like. And, you know, they will like go into it, and you're like, that's not, what are you doing? This isn't your thing. You know,
that's
definitely
what my period was like.
Yeah. You don't need
you
to
do know better you know. Than I do.
I'll do it better next time.
I'll make sure my period really conforms to your beliefs. Yes. Thank you.
I don't know how it works, but you know, we,
I'd be like, I don't know how it works. Yeah. I think, you didn't talk about periods at all in No Home for Killers.
I did, but I also don't go into, I don't go into first person, and I don't, and I don't think that's, you know, I'm also very conscious of identity and of appropriation, and I don't want to do that or be guilty of it. So, you know, I try to, but it doesn't mean you can't write certain characters. It just means that, A, you can be really called out on your BS if you get it wrong.
Yeah.
Which is totally fair. and has happened more so nowadays. And I don't think that's a necessarily a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. And I like to write from a male point of view as well. But again, I don't, if I write a male point of view, I don't put him in first person. It's not like, I, as a man, think, I'm like, nope, nope.
Well, right there, we don't think much.
Yeah, so I was just
here's your first mistake.
Yeah,
what it was.
We're just like walking down, you know, like a tree.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Well, and no, and I was going to say, I think you were talking about appropriation, and I was having trouble in the very beginning even picturing, because I'm like, who's on the cover of this book? Who is this supposed to be? Do you know? Like, was this based on any of the people that you were? So is this supposed to be, I'm like, okay, because their last name, the character's last name is Pena.
Yeah.
And it was, and one side of the family's from Panama. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what the father looked like. I didn't remember seeing something specific that said the dad is this, other than
at one point, Rebecca refers to Marcus as half white.
Right. And I didn't know if that meant like what his side was, the Panamanian side, because Panamanians can be pretty much any shade of the rainbow. So it's like, sure. All right, so half white. And then, okay, there's definitely, like, there was a lot of talk about, oh, her Spanish isn't so good anymore. And when one of the other characters shows up and starts speaking Spanish, or she's like, I speak English, let's not do this. Which I thought was hilarious, because it was such a character thing that I thought, the way that she's presenting this as if like, oh, I'm going to come talk to you in your language, with that, just all the presumption of what that means. That was such a nuanced scene, and I thought it was handled very, very well. And at one point I was bilingual. I lost it years ago. And when someone approaches you in a different language, it can have so many different contexts and so many different, like, oh, do you not speak the language? And just how that can be pejorative, and how that worked for this character. It was a good thing with that. But I was going to say, for this, you kind of had a cast of a family even that was covering different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I liked how you did that, because they all seemed to kind of take different places even within that, like where they even identified within that, including a husband taking a wife's last name, right, which is not super common.
Yeah. And there's the, you know, I didn't really know if I had a voice to, or that people could identify with, because I'm my mom's Panamanian, my dad's white. And I was always the only mixed kid growing up. And, you know, often I was sort of made to feel that way. And we live in a super diverse area right now, right outside DC. And my wife's Vietnamese, and my kid is this mix of like everything at this point. And and he's, you know, his school, it's fascinating, because his school is so diverse. Like, my wife and I, when we went there for like the tour, we were like, we're all the white kids. Like, it's crazy. And he'll talk about his friends, and there's none of that thing that happens with my age group where you're like, you know, where there's a stumble over a new name or anything. He's like, oh yeah, today I played with Sariana and Muhammad, and those names are like John and Paul.
That's true. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Whereas it's like wonderful. Our age, it's just like, I mean, every single friend I had in high school was named Jennifer, and yeah, they
that
were all
where you grew up, because
all white girls.
Yeah, where I grew up, I mean,
in New Hampshire.
Yeah, where I grew up was more mixed, and it is funny, because it does depend on where you grew up, because my family of origin is, you know, mostly white folk, but my dad's side, one of my dad's brothers married a woman who is half Okinawan, so I had cousins growing up who were a quarter Okinawan, and then as my family has expanded, we are basically covering as many continents as we can, where my sister's husband is Korean, my dad remarried after my mom died, and his wife has two sons who are both married to women who are African-American. So all the cousins all look totally different and don't have any of the same background. And some of them are genetically related and some of them aren't. And some of that's just like, well, that's just what our family looks like. So, all right, that's what we're doing here. But even where I was growing up, we had just different names and everything. But some places are more homogenous even within where they are. So like where my husband teaches, it's more Asian. So my husband comes and gets a roster and looks through all the names and tries to make sure he can pronounce them the first day, because he doesn't want to be that idiot who doesn't know how to pronounce students' names.
Yeah.
But it just kind of depends on where you are and just what your family dynamic is. But like mixed kids, my kids are the only ones who aren't mixed in our family. Like, sorry, you're just little white kids. Sorry about that.
I think that's such a growing thing, right? I mean, there's going to be so many people who, like, I never really belonged entirely to one you know, to either the white or Latino kids either way. And then I didn't, you know, I learned my first language was Spanish, which I promptly forgot when I learned English, and I've tried to get it back. And if I'm submerged, if I'm back in Panama for about a week, even just in a week, it comes back. It come, you know, but it would take a while. It would take like probably a year for me to really be a fluent speaker. But I do think there's a lot of people growing up, and especially kids growing up now, who are going to be facing that same thing. They're going to be like, you know, I don't really fit in with this group or this group. I'm not sure where I belong. And I think that's something that I think that's where I found, like, I kind of fit in.
Yeah, no, I definitely, I get that. Like, as a white woman, I'm like, but I'm also a bisexual white woman. So like for years, my whole life was just like, well, like, I'm not, like, now everyone's like, cool, yeah, you're queer, we get it. Yeah. But like in high school, I was just like, am I a lesbian? No. Yeah. Am I straight? No. What? I'm literally nothing. Like, it was just like, it made,
that's your nothing. Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, and maybe it's because I grew up in New Hampshire and nobody talked about anything.
Well, I was going to say, even it's changing now, not just more multicultural areas, but kids finding their sexuality earlier. And I mean, one of my kids has already said, oh yeah, you know, one of my friends, you know, she is a lesbian. I'm like, okay, well, remember, we don't let our friends date jerks. So your friends can date whoever they want, but they have to be nice people. That's it. That's the only rule. No jerks.
I think, yeah, and, you know, there's just so much of, right, I have this theory that I should probably try and write an essay about or something like that, but I think the new literary, like, movement is currently happening, and I think it's really going to be identity. Like, movements in the past have always been about prose and have been about, like, oh, romanticism is now realism, and now we're going to modernism and postmodernism, and I think it's, I don't think this is really going to be about style as much as voice and identity, and I think there's a lot of male white writers who are really opposed to that, but without the realization that identity isn't necessarily limited to diversity, is not limited to the color of your skin. I mean, neurodiversity, identity, sexuality, there's
experience, it's background. I mean, everybody has a different background that they bring to the table. And I think what happens, that's a problem, is when we're all forced to homogenize for this intended audience that they only can understand certain things within limited parameters. And I've heard both in, I'm in a Slack with other authors on sub where they've been told, well, readers won't be able to relate to this because it's not Western enough. And it's like, well, the whole point was it isn't a Western story. So don't make me Westernize the story. Let's let people experience these things and have those different voices. And it will come in more naturally rather than try to force it into that block of, well, this is what everybody expects. And it looks like this. And everybody's straight, white, and Christian, probably male. The end.
Yeah.
I think there's, there's two sides to that. And I don't mean two sides where I'm taking the devil's advocate. I mean, on one hand, when people don't want to read new experiences, I'm thrown off because as readers, that's what you do, right? You're reading a book so you get new experiences. But I also think, you know, the three of us were probably pretty avid readers. You know, reading books were at one point were probably good friends to us. I mean, you know, books, I can point to books and songs and movies and shows that have changed my life. And my wife has none. You know, she's very much the analytical side. She's like, I don't know a book that changed my life. And I'm like, that's, you know, and I grew to accept that. I understand it.
Like, I love you anyway.
But I think most book buyers in the country may not want that, right? They may just buy the same bestseller writer that you're reading James Patterson, not for new experiences, but to return to familiar ground.
Exactly. It's the same reason why I've rewatched The Office like 12 times.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's just the comfort of, okay, if I'm going to pick up a James Patterson novel or a V.C. Andrews novel or a Daniel Steele, whatever your gig is, you read it for the formula.
Yeah.
Right.
You read it for the escape because you know that these rich, fantastic people are going to have these problems you're never going to understand. They're somehow going to get away with everything. They're going to look fabulous. They're going to be drinking 97 bottles of wine a day. They're still going to have the perfect body. They never work out. They've had like 3 kids, but their boobs are still amazing. And you're like,
mine weren't amazing before the 3 kids.
Mine are fine.
Oh, us.
Okay, well, that's all that matters, EA.
I need that's what I'm saying.
No, and you're completely right, because there is that familiarity, and I have friends who will either reread the same book or will reread the same authors because it's familiar. And I know for me, what I used to do either at the library or my favorite used bookstore is I would pick up one book by an author I knew, one by an author I didn't know, but in a genre I knew, and then one just completely random because I had something safe. And if you're an avid enough reader, you have the ability to do both, to have that safety net, and then to also step out. And if it's like, these weren't good, I didn't get anything from it, okay, I still have the familiarity. And one of the lovely things about our show is we read, you know, we both have shows that are in our own genres that are supposed to be like the safety net. And then we have to push each other out of there. I've made you read romances, Jennifer. I'm sorry. I apologize, but I've made you do it.
I'm sorry, and too.
You're like, I am sorry.
I'm sorry about that. I don't like happy endings.
And science fiction and fantasy is technically my wheelhouse, but I pushed myself out to go start reading the romance when I started writing it, because apparently you're supposed to read in the genre you write. It's weird.
Yeah, I guess.
But
yeah.
So I've had to do that, that's too. And what's funny then is I've been trying to read rom-coms to get my brain in the rom-com vibe. And I read fail after fail after fail. And I was asking friends, tell me one that actually works. And thank God for Talia Hibbert, because I'm listening to one now and it's wonderful. And it's not that it's necessarily formulaic or anything, but she has that voice that you need for a rom-com. And that's what people are looking for. It's not that the voice is to be identical, but it has to be what you expect in terms of, will it fulfill my genre expectations? So I feel like there's that happy medium that you can have voices and experiences that are different, but they still provide that feel that you expect from a genre. Like if it's crime or thrillers, that suspense and that tension, if it's rom-com, that fun and the feels and all that stuff. And if it's science fiction or speculative, that it pushes your mind in places. But I still think there's room for different voices in all that. So I feel like there should be a way to do both and have both of those things together. I just don't know if it's being done or being done as well as it could be.
I feel like No Home for Killers does that, because I will say Emily isn't necessarily the typical voice of a character in crime fiction. Like, and I loved that.
So I think there's something.
She sparkled.
Talking, you know.
You made her sparkle.
When you mentioned thank you. But when you mentioned the idea of safety and comfort, you know, I think a lot about sitcoms and how, like, especially in the 80s, how they were built, you know, they always have this one central area. It's, you know, Cheers has the bar. The Cosby Show had the living room. Friends had the living room, you know, with them that they all shared. And there were these spots that you could return to where you felt a sense of safety, almost like late night shows. It's interesting to me that talk shows that are geared towards women always have a couch, and talk shows that are geared towards men
have
with male
desk.
Hosts have a desk. Yeah, like you're sitting at the office. It's really
weird. What does that tell you about Graham Norton? He's got a chair that will dump people out of it.
That's cool.
Have you seen Graham Norton? I love Graham Norton.
I have, but I didn't know about the chair, because I just see like little clips on the
chair. Chair is a segment where they will tell a story, and if they're tired of it, they just dump people out of it. It's not really guessed it. It's like a special chair. Yeah, well, there's like a couch and then Graham's in a comfy
there's
chair.
This sense of, you know, like familiarity and comfort. And I think, yeah, I think to your point, with I was thinking about this recently, like with writing, you don't really have this one scene you return to, or sometimes it's a character, but it's the voice, I think, that you really like. You're reading a book and you're like, I know this is this writer's book. You know, you know you're in a blank book because of their voice and their characters, and that sense of comfort, I think, is something that I think a lot about author's identity. I hate the word brand, but essentially the kind of their brand.
I get it. Brand sounds just so markety
what's my brand?
But it is something we have to think of. Like, so I have, you know, a book that my mystery book that's out on Sub, and we've had people come back to us say like, well, would she write this under a different name? And I'm like, sure. Like, whatever you need. I could be J.A. Gordon if you want me to. Nobody will ever know it's me, but I want to be able to own it. Like, I want to be able to still be on Box Vomitus and say like, hey, I also wrote this book under blah, blah, blah. I don't want it to be like this mysterious thing where I have to like be a different person.
I can speak to that, because I did that with my last book. They wanted it to be, they're gone. It was published under a pen name, and the name was E.A. Bars, and I wanted something that was close to my name, but it didn't work. I mean, I should have embraced it. That if I wanted to do that, what I should have done is embraced it completely. Said this is, you know, I wouldn't have owned up to it. I would have just, it would have been a separate website with a person. I know somebody who did this really well. And instead I just said, you know, hey, this is my book under a different name. And it
didn't work.
Really worked out. Yeah.
See, I always wonder, cause like, well, we had Mary Burton on the show and she is Mary Burton, like thriller writer. And also, and I can never remember the name that she writes, like women's for, like, fiction,
right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's like Beachy Reads.
Yeah.
And, but she, her website is like, it's almost like divided in two. It's like, click on this side, click on that side. And I'm like, but she also has a very established brand under both of those names. So I don't know, you know, 15 years ago, what her website would have looked like, or if it would have been two different websites.
And I think it also depends on whether you're doing it because, like, what's the reason behind changing the name? Because, like, for me, I write under two names, but part of it is for the branding for genre, because I'm Hubbard when I do spec fiction, and I'm Allison Martine for rom-coms. And part of it is because Hubbard is a lousy name for romances that just does not have a good ring to it. And Allison Martine sounds French and fancy.
And I'm flirty. Somebody eating macarons.
No, I joke. The author picture when I'm Allison Martine has no glasses and my hair is down. And then when I'm Allison and when I'm A.M. Hubbard, I wear my glasses and I look much more serious. But again, that's just for genre distinction, mostly because you want people to pick up a book and go, all right, am I getting a rom-com or a WTF spec fiction? Because they're very different. But I'm always very clear that it's me, and I've never been trying to, like, hide one or the other. It's just that I write in such different things. Were you writing something, Ed, that was very different from this? Was the other book stylistically really different so that fans would be confused? Why did they ask you to write under a different name?
So I thought about the ways to present it, but the real reason was because I had two books out way back one, and they were with a micro publisher, so tiny publisher, and they didn't get any marketing, any support, and just kind of died. And then my next book, those books are out of print, and I don't really mention them or anything. They're not even my.
We just pretend they're out there.
They're not there. But my first book, The Unrepentant, did pretty well, and it was with a small publisher, well for that publisher. And then the next book, They're Gone, was with a mid-sized publisher, and they were like, you know, because of your track sales with those first two books, we really don't think we want to go under a pen name. And I was like, that's fine. And I just hated it. But it's also not how I've built myself. You know, I spent a lot of time, like, doing events and working with organizations and stuff, partially to help people, partially to put my name out there. And
we get when that.
You change your name, you're like,
you lose it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you don't have that whole, like I'm a fresh as a daisy debut author, because you're like, I have like three books. So, and now it's just like my first book under this name.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, for me, it didn't work. I wouldn't, but I didn't have the right attitude. It wasn't necessarily the approach, just the attitude. I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like,
and I'm like, I would do it. Cause I would love to be, I was like, I jokingly, when I got like an email from my agent, like, would you ever consider changing your name? And I'm like, yes, I would. I've already considered it. I would like to be. And I, like, gave her a long list of names.
Here's like a list of names I will answer to.
I was like, the first one is already my burlesque name, so we probably can't use that. Or, and then it was like a ton of things. And she was like, that was a very fast response.
I think, you know, I've been thinking writers should really just use like really cool names. You know, like not an actual name, like a superhero would use or something like that. You know, like, right? I mean, call yourself like Dagger or something. That would be like, so if that's just the name on the book. What do
you do, Jennifer? You'd be just Dagger Island.
Just be Dagger Island. Oh my god, that's perfect. Dagger
Island. Tell Polly you're going by Dagger Island.
No. I'm just going, but yeah, or just I like just Dagger. And then if people like Googled me, they'd go, oh, do you think it's because she wrote books that took place on a fictional haunted island off the coast of New England?
Maybe.
Is it marketing? Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, I mean, look, rock stars do this all the time, right? They have one name. I mean, I think this is something that's going to happen, and we're going to be, you know, like.
And eventually we'll just be like the, like Prince, and we're just going to be like a symbol.
Right. Okay, yeah. So there is.
Maybe like a drawing of a little fat puppy.
my husband watches, and he has a book out where he's actually like, he did the he did the script and somebody else drew. So it's a graphic novel or a comic, whichever one. And I cannot find this man's name for the life of me, because even under the book, he's using his YouTube moniker. And I'm just going, what is his name? Everybody you watch on YouTube is either named Michael or Steven. Which is he? I want to know. Is he a Michael or a Steven? Because most of them are Michaels or Stevens. This guy apparently does not have a name. His name is just Ordinary Things. That is his name.
That's his name?
That's what his YouTube channel is, and he has interesting YouTube things, and we've watched him for a couple of years now. He is only under that. We cannot find his real name, and if you look up Ordinary Things, you'll see a picture of some British dude. Apparently, that's just his name.
Yeah, my kid, you know, I mean, I don't know about your kid, but I mean, his favorite thing to watch is YouTube, and we don't let him, but if he could pick anything to watch,
we're bad parents, like
YouTube. No. Well, we let him, but not all the time. But his favorite guys are like, what's this guy, Beast or something? Like, what's his name? Mr. Beast.
We don't watch Mr. Beast. Mine's always doing things where they're either building things or creating things. Mine is always taping things to everything else. I will come out to find something taped to something else. I don't know what. Mm-hmm. He has recently gotten silver Sharpies and colored all of his cars silver because they are now all DeLoreans. All of them are DeLoreans. Right now, we're really in the back of the future. So there you go. And he wants to turn everything into that or a Tesla. Which is three syllables to him, Tesla.
Yeah.
Alice that has a Tesla.
I don't have children.
Well, you're avoiding a lot of terrible YouTube.
I do which force is, my dog avoiding. To watch like TikTok though.
What are you both on TikTok?
No.
I lurk.
I scroll.
I even lurk. Yeah. I'm not on there very often, and my most watched last I checked was a video I took of a caterpillar that I put the Reading Rainbow theme over. That's about the extent of it. I tend to be on Instagram.
Like I do like Instagram reels, and most of those are just TikToks. But I mean, I'm so old that I have to be on Instagram.
I made these little promotional videos for the book with.
I saw those.
Oh, you saw those?
I want to see those.
Yeah, and they.
But I saw them on Facebook.
Yeah, I put them on TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. Although there's this huge backlash against using computer or like non-artist made graphics or something like that. I don't know. And AI. I was like, I'm going to get called out for this, but it's fine. I can do it till then. But I like TikTok because I don't post anything on there but those videos, but I like all the authors who are like bad at it, who are there because they've heard it's the way to sell books and they're all like,
Hi, I'm the author of The Native Wilder,
and you're like, oh wow, this is great. I love this.
You're like, this is why authors should just be typing. I will say an author that we talked to her a couple weeks ago. We love her, Amber Garza. She is great at TikTok. Oh,
some are so good. They are.
I'm just oh God, you're so good that I feel like I'm just like, I'm giving up before I even try. Like I'm not gonna
Amber's
do it.
Also like she's also like the awkward mom on there where she like admitted that she did not know until recently what Netflix and chill meant. And so she was like telling her kids that, and they're like, no mom, no.
I know. She like invited her son over to Netflix and chill. And he was like, no, thank you, mom.
This is why moms, when we're out of touch, we get really out of touch. And then our children refuse to be seen in public with us.
It starts with the mom genes, like Melinda, no home for killers. And then.
Yeah. Can I tell you guys a quick story?
Sure.
Get your opinion on it?
Sure.
So I went to a conference in Wisconsin, and the hotel we stayed at, a friend of mine told me when I checked in, he texted me, he's like, you know, I want to tell you, you're at the Dahmer Hotel. And I was like, what's the Dahmer Hotel? And he's like, that's the hotel where Jeffrey Dahmer killed somebody.
I'm sorry. I just like went crazy.
She's like excited. Like, I'm like checking out going.
So. I was like, okay, well, that's interesting. It wasn't like downstairs. There wasn't like a plaque or anything. But I Googled it and I was like, oh, okay, so he did kill somebody and then they had the room number. And I was like, you know what? I want to go to the room.
Take a selfie and like in front of the door.
Well, I didn't want to take a selfie, but I was just like, yeah, that's not is it bad marked taste. Off or anything? So I went up. It was like two floors up from me. And I went to the room. And apparently he brought some guy back from like a club down the street. And then he killed him in the room and he cut him up and carried him out in a bag.
Yeah, that's his gig. Like
that's his thing. That's his whole thing.
back to his house to make stew.
I went to the door. Nothing's on it. It's not marked off. It's still there and all, you know, just normal. Then I heard, this is in the middle of the afternoon, and I heard the sound inside. And I was like, what is that?
And it was really loud sex.
It was sex. And I was like, wait, this is like 2 p.m. and people are having sex in Jeffrey. And I, they and know?
I, I'm sure Jeffrey? They do, because I bet.
That's why is their thing.
It's probably their gig, and I'm not going to shame, because like king shaming is bad, and it was not me.
Okay, just checking.
No, but I'm really into serial killers in a an intellectual way, not like a sexual way. And but honestly, like my husband and I would probably like want to go to that hotel, but not mm-hmm. stay in that room, because like I'm also superstitious and scared of ghosts. So I'm like, mm-hmm. I just don't want that kind of crazy energy, and I would never have sex in a serial killer place.
Oh, I think I would have sex.
A cemetery, yes.
I called up my so I had a friend of mine staying at the hotel, and I was like, "Hey, you have to get up here. I'm outside Jeffrey Dahmer's room." And she was like, "Why would I go up there?" And I was like, "To listen." And she was like, "I'm not going up there." Now, who was wrong? She was okay. Wrong, right?
Am I the jerk stories? Which one of us was wrong in this social situation?
Not an AITA. But more like what a WCW was she WSW was she wrong?
I will say no. Neither of you are wrong. It was polite of you to invite somebody that you thought would get a kick out of that.
Extend the invitation. Good friends,
sociable and friendly.
Yeah.
And it's fine that she was like no, like I just don't want tea right now. And it's not like you were just like, you're going to come up here and listen to these people have sex with me in the serial killer room. No, like that would be
awful. No, that would have been weird.
That would be bad. And then I'd say, Ed, you are the wrong. But
no. Would you have come upstairs to?
I definitely would have.
Jennifer would have. I would have not. I would have been on the
really?
Other side.
Interesting.
No, because I probably, this would be me. I would be like, what are they doing? And you'd be like, come up here, Alice. I'm like, no. But what are they doing? And you're like, they just come here. I'm like, no. Can you put your speakerphone on? I just want to hear it.
Yeah, no, I will 100% say that I would have like been up those stairs so ridiculously fast with like my hand clamped over my mouth so I didn't like scream and laugh awkwardly like I do at funerals.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, I mean, I couldn't tell you what they were doing. I wasn't going to peek under the door because that seems like, A,
that's too much.
But B, that's probably too much.
Yeah.
I didn't also, didn't want to make a sound. Right.
And also, like, if you just stop and be like walking by the door and you can hear it, that is, they're probably hoping people hear it.
They're hoping they'll go viral, like someone's taking a video.
Yeah, like, oh, there's like sex going on in the Jeffrey Dahmer room. And then they could be like, that was us. We're so hot.
What if it was ghosts? What if it was Dahmer's ghost?
Don't say that.
It sounded like a woman. And I think.
And that was not his thing.
That wasn't his thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. It could have been ghosts.
I guess on that note, we're out of time.
Yeah, right.
Ed.
Good talk.
Great talk. Great, real serious conversation about No Home for Killers. But in all honesty, everybody who is listening or watching live or the replay, this book,
you need this
effing
one.
Loved it. No Home for Killers.
It's February 7th, so I don't know actually when it came out, but we've determined it's been out for long enough. Go get it.
Like a week to end or 6 weeks, who knows? We don't know how long it's been out. But I was given the paperback by you, and I also downloaded the Kindle when I saw that it was I don't want to say like the free book if you're an Amazon Prime member.
Yeah,
the first reads. Even though I was just like, oh, I already own that, and I still downloaded it, and I'm like, okay, no, that's fine. Like,
oh, that's lovely.
I was just so excited.
I really love talking with both of you. I was so happy to be invited to the show. I've listened to
Oh my gosh. I mean, nobody ever says that. They're usually like, oh no, we have to go on the Vox Vomitus now.
No, I loved it. I was so happy about this. So thank you so much for
having me. Thank you. You've been amazing. Everybody, tune in next week. We are talking to the author of Lovecraft Country and the upcoming, I don't want to say Lovecraft Country sequel, but
it's called Destroyer of Worlds.
That's
what you just sent me. I'm going
to
read it.
Destroyer of Worlds, parentheses, A Return to Lovecraft Country. Matt Ruff, little known author. Maybe his show was on HBO. Who knows?
I don't know.
So good. But stay tuned next week for that. And we will see you all then.
Bye.
Bye.